Hello, it's been a long break, but the Funds Fanatic podcast is back with me, Gavin Lumsden, talking to the movers and shakers in the investment companies world. For the relaunch, I'm delighted to say I have a real big hitter with me, none other than Chris Mills, the almost legendary UK smaller companies investor who's with me in the studio. Welcome to Citywire, Chris.
Thank you so very much. Pleasure to be here.
Great to see you. And Chris, you're the founder and chief executive of Harwood Capital. It's a London-based family-owned investment boutique with around £2 billion under management, much of it in smaller UK companies, both on and off the stock market. Best known for running two investment trusts, North Atlantic Smaller Companies and Oryx International Growth. But Harwood also manages private equity and real estate funds for its investors and private clients. And it lends to growing businesses in the UK and Europe. Chris, does that sum up what you do at your firm?
Yes, I think it sort of understates the team, though, to the extent that we've been very lucky to attract Stuart Widdowson and Ed, who run the Odyssey Investment Trust for us. And obviously, Richard Staveley joined recently. And he now runs Rockwood Strategic. And it was very pleasing that literally after the first year of joining us, he won the Best Fund Manager of the Year award. So perhaps he should be here today.
We're happy to talk to him in the future. So, yeah, it's a good team you've got around you. And I was going to ask you about the firm, but I may as well ask you now. You know, in addition, you've recently recruited Alex Illingworth from
That's Artemis. Correct, yes.
So that's an interesting one because the other people, too, you mentioned are kind of investors sort of in your mold, really, investing in UK smaller companies.
I agree.
Whereas Alex had a great track record helping to run or co-managing the Midwind Investment Trust. It's a global growth fund, really, isn't it?
Yes. Well, I think the first point is that we actually have clients who are global clients. So he was actually joining a firm where he would be running tens of millions of pounds, not hundreds of millions of pounds, sadly, from the get-go. We are certainly looking to expand his range of funds, possibly by acquiring other people's funds or grow it organically. And we certainly have every intention of building that team over the next few months.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it seems like your business starts to expand and grow after many years of kind of doing what it always has done.
Well,
you're expanding now, are you?
I kind of find that's just a little unfair. You know, I think it's worth remembering I was the founder of J. O. Hambro Capital Management and the largest shareholder. And we certainly built that a lot over the 20 years that I was involved in that. When I left, I was caught with a whole bunch of non-competes. So with Alan Durant and Richard Philbin, we started a business called Harwood Wealth, which we built from pretty well nothing with the help of another team, which is nearly $5 billion of funds under management. We sold that in 2019 to Carlyle. So yes, we've been doing quite a lot. We've certainly been building and strengthening our private equity team during the period. And, you know, we're a business, we reinvest 100% of our profits. So it's quite logical for us to grow as and when we see a good opportunity to bring in a good team.
Okay, but you've been investing since the mid-70s and you've been running businesses like this since the 80s. So you're not resting on your laurels. You don't mind me saying so. I think you've reached the 70s, but you've still got plenty to do, do you think?
Well, I think the answer is that the investment process is an investment challenge. And my personal opinion is if you disappear off to the sunset and hang up your boots, you're not going to be much longer for this world. So the challenge of working with clever people, constantly learning new things, figuring out how to do things better, and hopefully passing down some of the experience to the team that I've accumulated over nearly 50 years working in the city, makes it a very enjoyable thing for me and, frankly, honestly, don't consider it to be work.
It sounds like fun. And also, it's a family affair. You've got three sons working with you in the business.
Yes, they all do.
All your children?
All three children, yep. They all do very different things, which I think is probably a good idea because if they're all in the same department, I almost dread to think the consequences. So Charlie Mills runs our property side and is also responsible for the investments the firm makes for its own behalf. Nicholas Mills, who did 5 years at working for Mario Gabelli in America, ending up as a senior analyst and fund manager there, came back 5 years ago, and he's been with us now at Harwood for nearly 5 years, with his principal responsibility being Oryx, although obviously reporting to me. And then Harry is, having spent 5 years at N1 Singer, is working as the junior in our private equity business.
That's interesting. I didn't realize Nicholas was the fund manager of Oryx, in effect, or number two to you.
Well, he has day-to-day responsibility for monitoring all the companies. We obviously work together. But obviously, you know, there's a number of his ideas. Has sat on the board of three public companies now, Oryx Investments, Crestchick, which was taken over within a year of him joining the board, Niox, which has done very well. And the attraction of putting him on a board like Niox was that Ian Johnson is an outstanding corporate leader. And the job that he's done at Niox is truly extraordinary. The sales have gone from 32 million to say 40 million, but the profits have gone from a loss to sort of 12, 13 million this year.
Niox was a big positive feature of North Atlantic's half-year results recently. Could you just explain to the listeners what it does?
Okay, Niox does phenotesting, which means absolutely nothing to all of you, I'm sure. What phenotesting basically is, asthmatics have a level of nitrogen in their breath, and you have to measure that very accurately to enable you to do the right medication. Niox has about 95% of the phenotesting market, and that market has only been penetrated to the tune of about 6%. So it's a major growth opportunity, which actually we believe one day will be very valuable to a major pharma who can roll it out much more quickly. The company's got no debt, about 13 million in cash. And thanks to Mr. Woodford's generosity, a 600 million tax loss. This is the Ulster
Neil Woodford. Cassia.
Neil Woodford, yes.
Ah, the Ulster Cassia.
Correct.
Okay. So, and why the tax losses?
Because that's what the company managed to lose when Woodford was a shareholder.
And it can now take advantage of those.
And then the other one is on the board of is Hargreaves Services, which, again, has just announced that it's going to sell off its infrastructure assets, which were on the books for very little, and return very significant sums to shareholders. So all the things that Nick has done so far have been building shareholder value, making sure shareholders or boards are aligned with shareholders. And actually, in the three cases I've just described, they are.
Okay.
And but that's not always the case.
And I see from the website, he's a member of the, Nicholas is a member of the senior management team. So is he a successor to you when, you know, it doesn't sound like it's coming anytime soon, but when you do decide you've had enough?
Well, I hope he would be, but we've got other people who could equally be a successor. And just because it's a family business, it doesn't mean it isn't a meritocracy.
Okay. So there are other partners, other members of the team.
Well, I mean, you know, he's got to compete against, you know, it's like someone like Stuart or someone like Richard, who he works with too.
Okay. And just going, those examples you gave, is that typical of the kind of companies you're looking for? Specialist, financially strong, good market position?
Basically, the investment philosophy is to figure out which companies are trading a significant discount to their private market value. That, by definition, requires you to understand the businesses, the strength of those businesses, how those businesses will react in downturns, and the upside potential in them as well. So if you can build in the discount, and if you can also ensure it's not a value trap. So how do we deal with the value trap problem? The value trap problem is dealt with by discussing, going to the other large investors and discussing how they see the company, whether they'd be supportive of creating change. And obviously change obviously is, as I said, focusing the company on being run for the interests of the shareholders or the owners of the business rather than the management.
So in doing that, are you an activist? How would you describe yourself? Are you an activist? Because you like to take big stakes in companies and sit on their boards and influence their direction.
Okay, I mean, I suppose activism has sort of many connotations to it. There's activism where you're shouting out in public and frankly, I don't actually think that works. So what I would describe our activism is talking to other shareholders, trying to create a unity of purpose, and then implementing it. So, I mean, for example, Elementis is in the news at the moment.
I was going to ask you about that.
Elementis, the most, Franklin is one of the most passive shareholders in the world, came out and said, you know, this is a disgrace. This company needs to be put up for sale. The management turned them down, surprise, surprise. We're about a 4.3% shareholder between Stuart and ourselves. And we're now talking to
Stuart
all the other big...
at Odysseon.
The Odysseon. So we're talking to all the other big shareholders. And in fact, both Stuart and Andy Brough were in the Times yesterday condemning the board's reaction so far.
And coming out in support of... It's Franklin Mutual who are the leading...
And coming out in support of Franklin Mutual. I don't think... I'm just speculating here. I don't think Franklin Mutual will be the one to call the EGM.
So what do you want? That EGM would be called, you'd think, and shareholders would vote on forcing through a sale of some kind?
Well, I think the answer is that if the board continues to resist the will of the shareholders, then the EGM will basically take that decision out of the hands of the board and put it into the hands of the shareholders, for which it should belong in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a specialty chemicals company. What's it been doing wrong? It's not hitting its targets?
If you read the Franklin letter, which is in the public domain, it says it all. But basically, overspending for acquisitions, not running businesses well, concerned that they sold a business too cheaply, and on it goes. You know, the company has gone nowhere for years. You know, the last thing we want is for things to be broken up overnight. What we want is a careful, detailed plan. Over a reasonable period of time, we can maximize the value of this business. They turned down 2 or 3 years ago bids at 160. The stock's languished somewhere between 110 and 120 since then. It was 110 when Franklin put out their letter. Our view is the business is worth at least 160 and could be closer to £2.
Okay, so there's plenty to go for there. I mean, picking up on that idea of you sitting on boards, you and Nicholas and the other of your colleagues sitting on the boards of companies.
And Richard does too. Richard Staveley does too.
Absolutely. So at Rockwood Strategic. But thinking about, I want to connect to your role on the investment trust, because you also slightly unusually take an executive role on them. So you're the chief executive, for example, of North Atlantic Small Companies.
Yes, that goes back to history. Basically, in 1982, a bank called Investcorp wanted me to go and run their investment division when I was at Sammy Montague. To get me to stay, they basically allowed me to create my own fund management business within their business. And because I was given incentive packages which were tied to remuneration and tied to stock options and performance fees, I had to become an executive. And it made complete sense at the time. And, carried on happily ever since.
Absolutely. So could you tell us a bit more, why is it called North Atlantic? I mean, I've got an idea, but explain to the listeners.
Oh, God, okay. Well, I suppose it was originally called Consolidated Venture Trust.
That's not very interesting.
Which is not very interesting. And actually was originally called Montague Boston, if you go back to its history. So when I took it on in 1982, when I actually started running, it was 1981, the NAV was about 34p, and today it's about £52. So it hasn't exactly been an unhappy ride for people.
But it's investing in both sides of the Atlantic, in the
US
as well as
the UK. Much of the US portfolio now is in private companies. And much of the UK portfolio is the UK portfolio is more in public companies, although there is actually a reasonable proportion in unquoteds as well.
I did see that in the US about a year ago, you'd invested in a company called SMT Corporation. And having my investment trust hat on, I see SMT and think Scottish Mortgage. And no. Obviously, nothing to do with
that. Absolutely nothing to do with that. SMT is a very, very good business.
Defence business.
Yes. It sources components mainly for the defence industry. But much more importantly, it's one of the few companies in the United States who tests components for the military to make sure those components are not Chinese ripoffs.
Right.
And that is increasingly becoming a major issue of the Department of Defense in the United States. The business was bought for about $68 million. And in the year to March next year, I think we're on track to do something like $15 million of EBITDA.
Okay, that sounds like it's going places. And looking at North Atlantic and then comparing it with Oryx, they seem to have quite similar portfolios. What is the difference? I mean, Oryx is a Guernsey investment company rather than an investment trust.
Basically, the way it works is if North Atlantic can't put 15, 20 million pounds in something, it just makes no sense. It's just not enough. So, you know, one of Oryx's victories at the moment is Pendragon, which we bought a big stake on recently when Crispin Odie had to sell the shares of 15p. And now there are three bidders for the thing, and current share price is 33. £3 million in North Atlantic wouldn't make a difference, but that added 2% to Oryx. So big holdings in North Atlantic, which wouldn't be in Oryx, would be something like the investment in Ten Entertainment Group, recent purchases being Conduit Holdings and TPI Cap.
Okay. And because it's got that US dimension, the annual reports and results give a performance benchmark of the S&P 500, which
makes no sense at all.
Looks like a bit strange. Wouldn't something like, just because I was looking at Numis data recently, but wouldn't something like the MSCI Global Small Cap be a bit more relevant?
It's a legacy of history.
Okay, so you recognise it's not the best benchmark,
And it's not. And we talk, in our accounts, we do mention this is probably not the cleverest index to be in.
Okay,
I mean, putting yourself against the hardest index in the world to beat is challenging, shall we say?
Okay, and moving around a bit, because I was looking at the results, you've got a bit of a poncho on, it seems, or somebody has, for putting pictures of battles, sea battles, on your annual reports and results. The latest being on the half year is the Battle of Vigo Bay, 1702.
Yes. The answer is that I thought most investment trusts' annual reports were boring. So long, long time ago, I decided let's have a nice picture. They cost virtually nothing to put on. And we donate a little bit of money to the National Maritime Museum every year.
Okay, but why the maritime interest? Does that reflect your own
personal interest? No. That was because the first one was basically the Nonsuch heading across to America to make money, and we were heading across to America to make money.
I see.
So there was a kind of logic to it.
I get you. Okay. And getting into some of the detail here, but North Atlantic holds has a 12%, or 12% of its assets are in Oryx. And that's valued at NAV, net asset value, even though the shares in Oryx are trading at a
Yeah, because we own 53% of it, and we can basically consolidate the NAV.
Okay. But the shares of both trusts are trading at big discounts, in common with the rest of the sector at the moment.
Yes, what I would say is that the sector's actually got worse. Our fundamental problem, and one of the reasons I'll be on a program like this, is these are complicated trusts, what they do. If you look at the list of investments, the average person will go, Christ, I know nothing about most of these companies. Then in North Atlantic themselves, they see all these unquoteds and they don't know what those do. And there is a monster problem sitting out there in unquoteds, because all these tech companies that got these insane valuations, the next time they have to do a refinancing, they're having to reduce them. Our companies are really boring. I mean, really, really boring.
They make money.
They make money. The last one we just sold did property management. We made three times. We're about to sell a business in the pet food treat business. And that's going to be a big victory for us. That's three times on quite a lot of money. We're in negotiations to sell our medical packaging business. And again, it's the third largest medical packaging business in the United Kingdom.
And these private equity positions, they are, you hold them through other funds.
We hold, well, it's held both ways to add to the complications, okay? So they're held through the funds, which we own 25% of. We then hold them directly. So a company like Source Bioscience is held in both. And that was something that was basically delisted by us last year, but we actually paid a premium to the market to complete the delisting, and it's a 3 to 5 year breakup, with the first asset expected to go quite soon, which will result in a return of capital to us. So they're all real businesses, they all make money, and we hold them at valuations you can understand.
And all the private equity side.
For example, if it was the pet food business, if it was to be sold, we've already doubled the valuation, but it would be another 50% markup.
So you haven't seen write-downs on that of those unquoted businesses, because there's been lots of fears amongst investors that that's what's going to happen in private equity.
Not a single one. I mean, I'll give you some examples of ones that we hold directly ourselves, which ones we just increased in value. We have a big stake in a company called Performance Chemicals, which is a Midland-based oil service company. Midland, Texas, by the way, oil service company. It's got about $5 million in cash. It's made about $5 million in the year that's just finishing. Expected to do $6 million next year, and we're still only valuing that $25 million. Another one is Spring, which is basically a UK pharma company. That's valued at the moment about $60 million. It's paying down debt very rapidly. So in 12 months, we'd expect the debt to be down to $48 million, in fact, basically eliminated. The company last year did $12 million of EBITDA. So we're only valuing it 5 times. We were originally more concerned that this year we'd go backwards, because last year was a very good year, but this year started way better than budget. So, you know, you're heading towards a 4 times multiple. And, you know, when these businesses are sold, they're worth 8.
So you're finding cheap businesses, good businesses, and you're getting them to a proper valuation. What's your,
okay,
so more broadly...
And I can explain that, okay.
But what's your view of the state of the UK smaller companies market when trusts like yourselves and others are on wide discounts and investors are pulling out of open-ended small company funds?
Right. Can I just come to that question? The reason why you can buy these private companies so cheaply is they're small. What happens in private equity is that firms that aren't broadly based, just private equity based, want to go into the middle market because they want the fees. We've never really increased the size of our funds over the last 20 years. We've done it by increasing by inflation, and pretty well that's it. So we're still absolutely focused on where we made the money, where so many firms are now trying to play in a marketplace where they've never played before. Going back to the smaller company marketplace, there's a whole mixture of problems that are sitting out there. The first, which people don't really talk about, is that many of these defined benefit pension fund schemes are now, courtesy of interest rates, starting to move into surplus. So the fund manager wakes up one day and nothing to do with performance, but he's just had his fund redeemed because they want to put it into some sort of deal with Phoenix or Just or Aviva or whoever it is.
So they're locking down their liabilities and they stop investing.
Correct. The second problem you've got in this, by the same genre, is that the trustees of these funds are effectively very risk adverse. And the reason why they're risk adverse is that if they take an undue degree of risk and it fails, they can be held personally liable. So the average trustee says, it's a company's problem to fund this, not mine. I have no incentive to try and, well, he wants to improve the performance, but he has no incentive to take risk to improve the performance. So you've got that whole bunch of risks.
So institutions are disinvesting from UK equities generally, rather than, and not just the small companies, but it's particularly acute at that.
Well, it's more acute when you're at the small company end because there's less liquidity. The next thing you've then got is the problem of after Woodford, the FCA is interested in how long it takes a fund to liquidate itself.
And give investors
their money back. So, you know, it's very difficult if you've got some very illiquid investments sitting out there, which on normal turnover can take 2 years to liquidate. So that's sort of another problem that's sitting there. And then the final problem that's sitting there is there's just been mass redemptions across the board. So if you look back at what's happening in the IFA industry at the moment, is the clients are saying, I want to sell my investments because I want to pay off my mortgage. I don't want to put money in my ISA this year because I want to pay off my mortgage, or I can get 6% from the UK government or 6.2% from the UK government completely risk-free. Why do I want to take the risk? When I look at the AIM market, for example, which is down another 20% this year.
And what's your answer to them then?
There isn't an answer. The Mansion House thing, I suppose, will do something, and Phoenix for sure will do something.
In terms of encouraging investors back into the UK
market.
What
our job is to take advantage of this opportunity, use the fact that we have fixed capital, buy these cheap equities, and then figure out how to create value from there.
Absolutely. Well, I was wondering if you were showing a little bit of risk aversion yourself, and I'm sure you're not, but what I was going to get around to is that, you know, North Atlantic Trust has got, according to the half-year results, £107 million of cash, which I think you've gathered from, you know, very profitable bids and investments going well. But, yeah, that's about 15% of net assets. Why aren't you redeploying that money?
Okay, well, the first point is, and it's not a lot of money, is that there's still commitments to the private equity fund at that stage of about 10 or 11 million pounds. So it's not as good as it looks. The second aspect is that we had this huge victory in Augean, which dumped this a huge amount of money onto us.
That was 2 years ago. Waste processing company. Yeah, huge bid.
Correct.
And £390 million in cash for its investors.
Yeah, and we owned just under 30% of it across Oryx and other funds. So, and frankly, we've been looking at the macros that are sitting out there. And, you know, it's hard to be optimistic. You know, inflation is, I think, more embedded than people think. Yes, interest rates probably won't go up much more, but we certainly don't expect them to go down much either. And, you know, sitting and waiting sometimes is the right thing to do. I mean, there's many times we've been 100% invested, but this isn't an environment to do it. Now,
do you think there could be a further, you know, crash or setback in the market? Are you waiting for prices to get even cheaper?
UK equities are cheap. The risk is what happens in the United States, where they're less cheap. And then, you know, if you start looking at world trade, the problems sitting in China are just getting worse and worse. And I think people are going to be surprised at the mess that China could turn into over the next 10 years or so.
And that has a, you know, direct knock-on effect for your area in small companies.
Well, it doesn't have it has a macro impact on everything, because, you know, ships all go up and down with the tide, don't they?
So have you done this kind of, have you been this high in cash before in your years running money?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We went into 1987 with a lot of cash, thank God. It didn't look good at one stage. We had also a lot of cash by April 2000. I mean, a lot. In fact, even more than we do
today. Again, well-timed.
As a percentage of the fund.
So if you're right, then that is a prudent thing to be doing. What areas might you redeploy the money in when the time is right or conditions improve slightly?
What we're doing now is Oryx is making a number of small investments. The way it works, really simple, is we get to know a company in Oryx, and when North Atlantic buys it, people are going to know we're on the register. So we have a shopping list. You know, there's something I'm bidding on at the moment, which would be quite a lot of money, but they don't seem to want within the spread, and I'm not going to pay outside it because I know I'm the only buyer.
Right. So you're a canny buyer, and you don't buy if the price isn't right.
Correct.
Okay. And when do you think you're cautious? You might turn more positive. It sounds like you're waiting for some big things to improve in the global economy.
Okay, well, things constantly change. So you see that level of cash, but I know we're doing a really big and really good deal in the United States at the moment, which is a business which makes food ingredients. They're very specialist food ingredients with massive market shares into the cheese industry. And then it has a food manufacturing and a food, it's a food manufacturing business as well. The pallet's probabilities, we're going to put 20 million into that.
So that will eat into that pile.
Yeah.
So there are things going on.
But the trouble is it goes both ways. Mm-hmm. So, Harwood Private Equity is going to spew out probably 25 million of cash soon.
Is that because it's selling stakes in these unquoted companies?
Yes. But then again, we're starting six. And we've already got the first deal lined up for six. And that's going to require me to put in another 20 million pounds. So having a healthy cash balance, if you're running investment trusts, you can't go out and ask your investors for more cash and not more cash is coming in. So you need to have a strong cash balance. Because we're kind of like running a mini conglomerate. We have to know how the cash flows work across. And on top of it, as you'll see, we constantly keep nibbling buying our own stock back.
Which is making a good return at 31% discount.
Yeah, I mean, it has to compete with the other uses of the funds, though. If I think I can make three times on a deal, I'm not going to spend that money buying the stock back. But yes, it's a constant thing. And indeed, one of the things that we've discussed with the board is that if I'm no longer running North Atlantic, the trust will prioritize buying stock back, as long as it's at a discount, over making new investments in the public marketplace, not the private marketplace.
Okay. And so we're getting towards the end of our time, and last sort of question really, it sounds like you're still quite motivated, but what is driving you on to sort of redeploy this money and get good returns?
Well, very simplistically, if you take the NAV, I've the family and I've got £210 million in North Atlantic. It doesn't take a genius to work out that I want to improve that value over time.
And if you narrowed the discount, if that discount disappeared, that would be...
Well, no, that doesn't change the 210 million because that's at NAV.
Right.
So I am very motivated to increase the overall assets of the fund through capital appreciation. We are never going to issue a share. That's out of the question.
Okay. So difficult times, but for a long-term investor, what's your view on your sector? What would you say to people who may be a bit discouraged by some of the things you've been saying?
Well, I hope they haven't been discouraged because I've tried to say there's a lot of value sitting there.
Yeah.
People like us are determined to get that value. I mean, I think if you look, for example, when I went on the board of Curtis Banks, the company was up for sale.
Self-invested personal pension provider.
Correct, yes. I mean, the company's put up for sale within 3 months. Within 9 or 8 months, we had a bid. It's taken a bit longer to close it than I would hoped, but that happens in October.
Right. So watch and wait, because when you're involved or when your team's involved, things seem to happen.
That would be a good message.
Okay. Let's leave it there for now, Chris, but thanks very much for your time. It's great to see you.
Thank you very much indeed.